This is Terms of Reference. I'm your host, Stephen Laddick. Karn Ross is the founder and executive director of Independent Diplomat. Karn served as a British diplomat from 1989 to 2004 in a number of different roles, including a speechwriter to the Foreign Secretary of the UK. From 1998, he was the UK's Middle East expert at the United Nations in New York. In 2004, he resigned from the UK Foreign Office after giving then-secret evidence to the first official inquiry into the Iraq War. Karn is also an author of two books. Most recently, The Leaderless Revolution, How Ordinary People Will Take Power and Change Politics in the 21st Century, and Independent Diplomat, A Critique of Contemporary Diplomacy. Karn is a frequent commentator on international affairs on the BBC and Al Jazeera, and in publications including the Financial Times and The Guardian. I spoke with Karn in New York. Hi, Karn. Thank you so much for being on the Terms of Reference podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where am I calling you today?
New York City.
Oh, I hope that the weather hasn't turned too cold for you yet.
No, not quite yet. It's turning a bit grim.
Excellent. Karn, can you, let's start off by explaining what the focus of Independent Diplomat is and what your role in the organization is?
We advise democratic countries and political groups on how to find their way in diplomacy. They may be disadvantaged for one reason or another, and we help them get what they want in the diplomatic system. My role is I'm the founder and executive director.
So what does that mean, that to find your way in diplomacy? Would are you talking directly to, you know, in the United States, it would be the State Department or their equivalent in other countries? Or?
Yeah, the diplomatic system, you know, formally is governments and international institutions like the United Nations, the European Union, the African Union, et cetera, et cetera. And so we engage with all of those places, with individual officials and diplomats of governments and of the UN. And we talk to them about what our clients need and want. And on that basis, we advise our clients and help them get what they want from these governments and institutions.
You've spoken specifically about the formal system there. Do you also work in non-formal systems, you know, back room, back channels, those kinds of things?
Yes, there's always a bit of that in diplomacy, and increasingly the people who have influence in any particular diplomatic decision range far beyond governments and officials. It may be private companies, it may be NGOs, it may be individuals, even film actors who can be significant in any particular political outcome. So we try to engage with all of those.
I'd love, you know, one of the things that we try to do here on the podcast is to focus on stories of success and failure. Is there any one that you can talk about with a film actor that you're allowed to?
Celebrities, you know, it's well known that they get involved in various political issues, and we advised South Sudan before its independence, and George Clooney, for instance, was quite heavily involved in that issue and was an important influence in persuading the US government to support South Sudan's independence. So our client, who was the government of South Sudan, talked to George Clooney. That would be a good example of a film actor who's involved in a diplomatic outcome.
How do you go about managing, not only, you know, I'm thinking of everything, of personality from George Clooney to, you know, your standard bureaucrat within a standard, you know, or a formal diplomatic system. Is much of your work managing those personalities and making sure they're talking the same language, or how does that work?
Yes, it is that. I mean, there's a fairly established professional culture in diplomacy. You know, diplomats know how to talk to each other, and we're a group mostly comprised of former diplomats, so we know how to speak that language. It's not desperately obscure or arcane, but like most professions, you know, there are particular ways of doing things, and one tries to respect that in dealing with diplomats. You know, diplomatic language and respecting those, that culture, can be a way of addressing very difficult issues without necessarily provoking conflict.
Do you have a specific example of how that might work?
One of the things about the United Nations, where I worked at the UN Security Council, is that you're dealing with people who don't agree with you. You're dealing with extremely contested issues like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, for instance, which I dealt with when I was a British diplomat at the Security Council. And I would talk to Iraqi diplomats, and, you know, our relationship was very professional and cordial, even though our governments were deeply hostile to each other.
How does then that relationship translate into moving the needle in the official positions of the government, or is there a way to describe that?
The role of the diplomat in that case is just to be very clear in communicating what it is that you want to another government and vice versa. And, you know, if you get emotional about things or put your own personal interpretation on things, you're not clearly communicating that. And so you're not behaving professionally. And, you know, I don't know about moving the needle. Britain never persuaded Iraq, Saddam Hussein, to do what it wanted, namely to disarm at that point when I was working on it. But, you know, at the least, Iraq, Baghdad, the capital, Saddam Hussein himself, would have a very clear understanding of what my then government wanted.
I've read in your profile online, and as it's described on the Independent Diplomat website, you know, you'd made the decision to start an independent diplomat after that, your tenure as at the UN. Can you walk me through that? Was there an aha moment? You said, this is a service that I needed, or was there a moment of frustration? You said, this is a missing thing, or how did that work?
My breach from formal diplomacy, from being a British diplomat, happened because of the Iraq war. I had worked on weapons of mass destruction, and I believe my government had not told the truth to its own people or to the world about what it knew about Iraq's WMD. That's now a very familiar issue, but that was the reason I resigned from my government. And I wanted to stay in diplomacy. And I had noticed, you know, this particular deficit in diplomacy, that very often when I was sitting in places like the UN Security Council, the people most affected by our decisions were not in the room. Indeed, they were barely consulted or even not consulted at all. And that seemed to me very wrong, not only in that it was very unjust, but it actually also created bad outcomes, because if you're not consulting the people who your decisions are affecting, how can you possibly expect that those decisions will have impact and will be sustainable?
Again, give me an example of a voice that wasn't heard at the Security Council during that time, during the Iraq War, that was what you believe was essential to, and maybe could have changed the tide completely.
Ordinary Iraqis, how about that? a group of people who were not consulted at all, as far as I remember, before, you know, in all the diplomacy over Iraq. We always engaged with a government that was not representative of its people. You know, the needs and wants of ordinary Iraqis were absolutely ignored in all of that diplomacy, including the period when we imposed pretty rigorous sanctions on Iraq. So that would be a pretty good example. I also dealt with Kosovo before it became independent. And Kosovo was, in fact, explicitly prohibited from having any diplomatic representation before it became an independent country. And that was a ludicrous situation. Kosovo was engaged in a very high-stakes diplomatic process to determine its final status, which, had it gone off the rails, I think would have resulted in a renewed Balkan conflict. And yet Kosovo was actually prohibited from engaging in that diplomatic process. And in fact, Kosovo became the first client of independent diplomat to try to help them engage with that process, because that was a travesty that they were not allowed formally to participate in it. They were just subjected to it.
And you've given me a great tee up for my next question. When you made the decision to break from being a formal diplomat to starting independent diplomat, did you already have a plan in place? Did you say, you know, did you put a structure together and you say, here's how I'm going to pursue my clients? Or, as it sounds like, maybe the Kosovar government sort of, you know, you knew that relationship and you came in and said, what if I do this on my own? How did that work out?
Well, it was more the latter than the former. I didn't have a grand plan of setting up this organization. You know, it was a very difficult time for me. I had left the career I thought would be the rest of my professional life, namely being a British diplomat. At that time, I was living in Kosovo, and so I had relationships with the leadership of Kosovo. And my wife, in fact, suggested that I consult with them, that I be their advisor. And that's how it began, at that really quite informal level. I, you know, approached the Kosovo Prime Minister, who I had quite a good relationship with, and said, look, can I come and advise you and help you with the final status process? And he agreed. And that was the beginning of it.
At that point, were you officially independent diplomat, or was it just Karn Ross?
It was just me in those days. The name came about after that.
What's your process for acquiring new work at this stage, is it still mostly relationship and referral based, or are you actively pursuing areas of the world where you think there's a deficit in informal diplomacy?
It's a bit of both. We're now quite well known inside the quite small world of formal diplomacy, so we get quite a lot of people coming to us, or referrals from third parties of countries who think that there is a particular political situation where there is a group, a democratic, a representative group that might need help with its diplomacy. So that's probably the predominant way that we get new clients. But also we keep a watching eye on a lot of what's happening in the world, where there's political turmoil or conflict. And sometimes we will approach countries or governments or political groups to see if we can be helpful to them.
In those situations, or even in the situations where you are brought business through your referral network, what's your most typical, or what's the most typical ask to you? What's the most typical deficit in advising someone in diplomacy? Is it process? Is it understanding protocol? Is it just understanding strategy?
That's a really good question. I mean, the first thing is just understanding what the hell is going on in any diplomatic process, because often that is very obscure. You can't find it on a website, and the way the press report it may not be accurate in terms of what is really going on. So I think one of the profoundest and most important services we can provide our clients is simply explaining to them what is really going on behind the scenes between governments and in places like the UN. And that is incredibly valuable, because it's not obvious if you're an outsider. And even, plenty of countries struggle to really know how power works in international relations, how the big, powerful countries actually determine decisions.
It sounds like you are in an enviable position that you are working with clients who really take your advice and action, and operationalize it almost immediately. Or are you there essentially handholding through the entire process?
It depends. Some clients just want general strategic advice. They're very capable themselves of implementing that advice. Others want a more thorough support throughout the process of, everything from deciding a strategy to actually implementing it in terms of meeting by meetings, speaking notes for presentations to the UN or diplomatic communications. And we will do all of those things. But we're very much at the service of our clients. We do what they ask us to. We don't impose on them. We don't tell them what we think they should be doing, which in some way sets us apart from a lot of the NGOs out there. We don't have an agenda. Our agenda is service. And that is a very powerful model, because it really helps build trust between us and our clients.
So, two-part question there. How do you remain? One of the key pieces in your literature and on your website is that you're an absolutely neutral organization. How do you maintain that neutrality? And you just described it is one of the most powerful, I would even say, tools that you have, for selling your services. Why is that so powerful when, we sort of live in an age of positions?
That's a good question. I think to offer to help people humbly and to say, look, we will do whatever you ask us and nothing else but what you ask us is actually quite unusual these days, particularly in conflict and, the maelstrom of governments and NGOs, all of whom are trying to, impose their own agenda on events. Even well-thinking NGOs often have agendas, and that's okay. That's legitimate. That's what they're there to do. But it's very refreshing for our clients actually to have a group of people come to them and just say, look, we are putting ourselves at your service. And that is very unusual these days. And we have found that that's a very powerful way of building trust with potential clients. And that trust is essential, because foreign policy is a very, very sensitive thing. It's usually decided at the most senior levels of government. It concerns national security. It concerns the profoundest interests of a state or a group of people. And you really, really need to trust your advisors if you're going to get proper advice from them, because we, as their advisors, really need to understand what it is that they want. And that's one of the biggest challenges for us, is really to understand what our clients want, because very, very often it's not what people think they want. I mean, one of the brilliant things about our work and one of the fascinating things about diplomacy is that invariably, when you go to a group of people, whether it's a desert liberation movement or a country that wants to be independent or a more established country that wants something in a particular negotiation, you think you know what they want, but you don't. Actually, you go and ask them and you find out it's something different, something more sophisticated, something more complicated, something more subtle. And that is really interesting.
Is there any particular example of something that even surprised you, a veteran of this particular business that you could share with us without breaching confidentiality?
Well, the breaching confidentiality bit is difficult because we obviously have to be scrupulous about protecting our conversations with our clients. And, you know, that intimacy is part of our success. It's part of our business model. So it's very difficult for me to talk about specific examples, but only to repeat that I'm often very surprised. You know, although I've been doing this for many years now, I'm often very surprised when I talk to governments and I say to them, why did you do this? And they say, well, actually, we were trying to send this signal. And I say, that's extraordinary. I had no idea you were trying to send that signal. Because what it appears is you're sending a completely different signal. And, you know, that's why people need good diplomacy, to try to be clear about what they're communicating. Good diplomacy is in its essence very straightforward. It is clear, robust communication about what your needs are. That is surprisingly difficult to achieve.
The answer to this question is somewhat obvious, but I'd love it if you would pontificate for a second. How much of that is culture and context specific, either the sending of an incorrect message or the expectation that we're going to send this message and a certain point will get across, and yet the person receiving the message completely misses it?
It's always culture and context specific. The invariable problem of all diplomacy of every government, and I include the most sophisticated, most established, most experienced governments in terms of their diplomacy, the invariable problem is that they think that everybody understands what it is that they're saying. And what they're saying is invariably formed by the domestic context. So even the United States, the president will say something which the international audience will listen to, but his primary audience is the American people, and his message will be crafted for the American people. And it always is, even if he's delivering an address to the UN General Assembly, the world countries assembled in front of him, his language and his messages will always be conditioned by what is going on domestically. And in another context, for instance, a Kosovo politician may be saying something publicly, writing an article, delivering a speech or whatever, and he will be talking in a language which is entirely familiar to him in terms of his domestic needs and the sorts of messages that work for his people, that those messages may be entirely incomprehensible to an international audience. So, you know, what you're trying to do in diplomacy is to interpret those messages in a way that the international community can make sense of. And that usually means making them very simple, very straightforward, because countries are stupid. You know, they don't have time to consider the complexities of what's going on in Somalia or Kosovo. Officials are far too busy. You know, frankly, a lot of them are very ignorant of the places they're dealing with. So you have to spell it out to them in very simple terms. And that's, you know, that's one of the fundamental jobs of a diplomat. It sounds very basic, and it is basic.
Have you ever participated in, you know, one of these, you know, peeling of the onion exercises, essentially, and had to recuse yourself from a process because of a misstep, or had to recall your staff because you were, you know, the services you were providing just sort of backfired?
That's a very good question. Our work is highly political. It's very sensitive. We're often involved in very, very volatile situations. We have to be guided by a clear sense of our own values. We will not help people who are engaged in the repression of human rights or breaking international law or not promoting democracy. These are very clear criteria which guide our work, and we're very explicit about that with our clients. And if our clients, whether it's a country or a government or political group, breach those criteria, we will withdraw from the relationship. And we have done that on a couple of occasions. Most recently, we did it in South Sudan. We had advised South Sudan for many years on its independence process. And as you probably know, violence broke out in South Sudan at the turn of the year, 10 months ago. And it became clear pretty quickly that the government was engaged in violence against its own people. And as soon as we realized that, we withdrew.
I'd like to just focus shift the focus of our conversation for a few minutes on, you know, you founded this organization and how you maintain it and run it. You have representatives all over the world. What do you find the most difficult aspects of being the director of Independent Diplomat at this stage? Is it the fact that you're on an airplane all the time? Is it acquiring new clients? Is it maintaining the work of the diplomats you have out there?
You're describing a lot of the things that dominate my life. I'm afraid to say the big things that most concern me are things that are very familiar to anybody who runs a nonprofit, which is raising money. You know, we do something very unusual that's quite difficult to explain, and it's therefore very difficult for us to raise money. A lot of the traditional foundations and sources of donor funds are not interested in supporting us, so I spend a lot of time worrying about that. The other thing is a little bit more specific to what we do, which is it's really hard to find people who can do this work effectively. It takes quite a special person to be able to leave an established diplomatic service, say of the US or Britain or Germany, of a powerful country, and go to a much more uncertain world where you're advising, say, the representatives of the people of the Western Sahara, who are a political group based in refugee camps in southern Algeria. That's quite a leap to make. I mean, for me and my colleagues, I think a lot of us have found that extraordinarily exhilarating and exciting as a leap. But it takes a special person to make it. And so finding the really, really good people in what is actually quite a small population of diplomats, because there aren't actually that many diplomats in the world, surprisingly enough. There's only really a few thousand. Finding amongst that cohort the really, really good people who are able to have the nimbleness and agility and creativity to advise groups of people who are often in extraordinarily difficult, challenging situations, that's difficult too for me.
Do you find that the human resources, for lack of a better term, your team that you've put together, are they essentially entrepreneurial in nature? Do they have that quality? Or are there just a whole bunch of intangibles that you're able to identify and say, this is the right kind of personality that's going to be successful with us?
Also a really good question. It slightly depends. You want a mix in a team. You don't want everybody to be super entrepreneurial and going out and doing their own thing, although, you know, an ability to operate autonomously is really important. You know, you want a mix of somebody who's going to keep the ship steady and somebody who's going to be charging ahead. But I think in terms of advising our clients, the most important thing is an acute sense of political judgment. You know, somebody who can almost feel intuitively what's going on in a political situation and make a judgment about what is required to change that political situation. And that's a real gift. And I think people are honestly born with it. They've either got it or they haven't, and you can't teach it. And there's really very, very few people who've got it. Even when I was a British diplomat, you know, I knew very, very few people who had that skill to actually transform a political situation through their own judgment of how to, you know, move, maneuver within it. I know I'm not being very clear, but it's a very special thing, and those people are very rare.
Sure. You've just described the intangibles that I'm sure are present. You know, if you were talking to any entrepreneur, it's the great salesperson who understands the crowd. It's the manager who understands the team. In this case, it's the diplomat who understands either the process or the clients that they're working with. And it's that magic, that magic touch. If we could, if we could find it, you and I would write a book and we'd be billionaires right now. just a few more questions. First, was there either a time after you made the leap to start Independent Diplomat where you just said, oh gosh, this was the wrong decision, or were you, you know, you found yourself in a position where you completely failed, and what did you do about that?
Particularly in the early years, there were a lot of very difficult times. I don't think I ever regretted doing it, because I'd really burned my bridges behind me. There was no going back. And I was very convinced of the rightness of what I was doing, not in a self-referential way, but just simply that it was something that was needed and something that, you know, was worth doing. And that was very clear from the outset. You know, the Kosovars really valued what I was doing for them. and, you know, made a difference. And I think even people on the other side of the table, the negotiators for the UN or the other big countries, felt that it was helpful. So, you know, that was demonstrably worthwhile from the beginning. But, you know, setting up an NGO from scratch, even running an NGO when it's more established, is not easy. You know, you're trying to keep lots of moving pieces aligned at once. It's intrinsically more uncertain than working for a government. You simply don't have that security, you know, working for a big institutional government gives you. And I do miss that sometimes, you know, certainly in a personal sense. I miss, you know, the financial security. I do lie awake at night sometimes worrying, golly, you know, what happens if this relationship goes south or we don't get that grant? I'm sure every executive director of a nonprofit goes through the same thing.
That said, you're clearly passionate about what you do, and you even said earlier in the interview that, you know, you had become a diplomat thinking that was, you know, that was your profession, that was your career. How did you find your way into diplomacy? Did you wake up one day when you were a youth and said, I'm going and working for the government, or was it another path that led you there?
It almost was that. I've always been a political person. I've always been fascinated by international affairs. Even when I was a boy, you know, I would read the newspaper every day very thoroughly. I was fascinated by what was going on in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation. I was fascinated by nuclear disarmament talks between East and West. I was very gripped by the anti-apartheid struggle, which was one of the big issues I became involved in as a student in England. You know, I never went to South Africa. But I was really gripped by international affairs, and I, to be honest, found them so much more interesting than domestic politics. You know, they were more dramatic, they were more exciting, they were more colorful, and I always wanted to work with them. And there's actually very few ways that you can really work in international relations except by being a diplomat. Diplomacy is really, in some ways, still the central discourse of how international relations are determined. Of course, there's many, many other factors as well. But if you want to do international relations, you've kind of got to be a diplomat. And so that's why I wanted to do it.
My final question is one that I ask every guest we have here on the show. And it's quite simply, you know, most of our audience are either individuals who are seeking to make a transition in their career or maybe start their own organization. But they're all focused on the humanitarian aid and international development space. Do you have one or two, or maybe more, pieces of critical advice that you would offer up to them about how to be successful?
Find something you love. It's kind of obvious. But you will only suffer the vicissitudes of, you know, setting up an organization or pursuing what are quite difficult things to achieve if you really, really care about it. If you don't care enough about it, don't do it. Because you won't survive, you won't prosper in terms of setting something up or really getting momentum in terms of achieving things. It's too hard. You know, there's many, many obstacles and challenges, and you will get through them if you really mind about it and if you're determined. And I don't necessarily mean just putting in the work. It's just conveying things with passion, building a team around you who share your concerns. You can't do this if you don't really care about it. That's by far the most important thing.
Karn, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Wonderful questions. I really enjoyed the discussion.
You've been listening to the Terms of Reference podcast from aidpreneur.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes.